You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, have you ever seen one of those basement toilets that's just kind of there in the middle of nothing? Turns out it's kind of a Wisconsin thing. We'll check out the story behind the freestanding bathroom fixture. Now, earlier this month on Central Time, we talked with the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health about the shortcomings of mental health care in the United States. Children's Wisconsin in Milwaukee has taken a step to fill some of the gaps in service, opening a new walk-in mental health clinic last week. Amy Herbst is Vice President of Mental and Behavioral Health for Children's Wisconsin. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of things were you hearing from patients when it came to access or lack of access to mental health care in your part of the state?
So we were hearing from families that it was taking too long to receive the mental health care that their children needed, whether that be a therapist, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist. They were really feeling like they were getting to a place of crisis before they could access the care that they needed.
Can you talk about the process of putting together this walk-in clinic and trying to meet the needs that you were just talking about?
Yes. So this clinic is really the direct result of us listening to those kids and families who were telling us they needed more immediate options when it came to caring for their children's mental health. And it also was in response to those providing mental health care were saying, you know, we're doing everything we can, but we can't always be immediately available to families. And sometimes that's exactly what families need. So we've got to create something that was new and different.
So who should come to this clinic and when?
So that's such a great question. So we are really trying to be clear with families about who should come and when they should come. And so we are looking to serve kids and families where they're having new or worsening issues related to anxiety, stress, depression. Maybe they're having a loss of interest in things that the child typically enjoyed, trouble focusing, maybe a loss of appetite that's very concerning, feeling of isolation. Maybe they're having some flare-ups from some mood disorders, sleeping difficulties, difficulties with school, absolutely. And so if those families are feeling like this is urgent, we cannot wait for our therapy appointment. We cannot wait to get off the waiting list. We don't have an emergency here, but we do have an urgent issue. We're telling those families to walk into our walk-in clinic.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that because I mentioned the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, a lot of times that first point of contact with the healthcare system, the mental health system, is that crisis in the emergency room. It sounds like part of the hope here is to deal with that maybe acute problem before it develops into that crisis emergency stage.
Yes, that's exactly what we're hoping to do. And this is one component of a variety of things that we're doing at Children's to try to meet the needs of our kids. So what we're saying is, please come to this walk-in clinic before you find yourself in an emergency and needing to call 911 or go to a psychiatric crisis service or come to our emergency department. Hopefully we can help you sooner.
Talking to Amy Herbst, Vice President of Mental and Behavioral Health for Children's Wisconsin, looking at a new walk-in mental health clinic there. What kind of help does that kid get? They've had their appointment there. What kind of things do you do to help them in the long term?
Sure. So in the long term, what we're able to do is provide a lot of navigation services to families. So immediately you can come to us and we'll assess your situation, we'll do some evaluations, we will meet your immediate urgent needs. And it doesn't stop there. We will stay connected to a family until they are connected to whatever long-term mental health care that they need. So that might be outpatient therapy, that might be a psychiatric evaluation, that might be inpatient hospitalization, whatever it is, we will see that through with you until you get to where your child needs.
Let's bring on a caller. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to commend the idea concept of this urgent clinic because psychiatric help for children or people with autism, ADHD, things like that, and everything that's encompassing with those things are so difficult for people to get immediate care and or care within like a 6-month, 7-month time frame. And I'm wondering if they're going to have an expansion maybe to young adults, because when you get older, it doesn't go away. You're always going to have autism, ADHD, anxiety issues. What options would they be able to provide possibly in the near future for something like that?
And Jeremy, is this an issue in your family?
Yeah, it is an issue with my family. We struggle so much trying to get just basic, you know, care for my son during his autism and with his autism. And psychiatric help and psychologists, they're just so overburdened. And you never got a chance to really get in there. But 7 months later, whatever happened 7 months ago is moved on to something completely different, you know.
Jeremy, thank you so much for sharing your story and your family story. First of all, Amy, that 6 or 7 month wait that Jeremy is talking about to get mental health care for a kid or a young adult for that matter, is that part of what you're trying to cut down on here?
It is. So, Jeremy, thank you for your comments and question. We are trying to address that wait time in a variety of different ways, and the walk-in clinic is one of the ways that we're working on that. And then in terms of young adults, you know, we were literally having that discussion earlier this morning again at Children's, and we do provide a significant amount of mental behavioral health care to young adults for a variety of reasons and issues. And we're talking about how can we do better on our own and in partnership with others so that we can provide that continuity of care into that young adulthood, because that does very much matter to kids and families. And then in terms of kids with autism or other issues, I'm really happy to be able to tell you that we recently hired an excellent and fabulous doctor that is going to lead up some work for us so that we can do better taking care of kids and families with autism. So more to come on that from us, but you should be able to see some real improvements from Children's in that space.
Thanks for the call, Jeremy. Amy, the official opening of the walk-in mental health clinic was last week. I understand there was a soft opening, though, last month. How are things going so far?
Yes, you're right. We had a soft opening, and then we opened to the public last Tuesday, March 8th, and we've been busy. So we were estimating that we might see an average of 5 kids per evening, and I can tell you the first day that we were open to the public, we saw 6 kids that evening. And so we've been busy, and we've been busy dealing with individual issues that are unique to each family and helping them get that care that they need in the moment. And then, of course, after they leave the walk-in clinic as well. And so we expect to stay busy, and we will be open on weekends starting this weekend.
Amy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for covering this. We appreciate it.
Amy Herbst is Vice President of Mental and Behavioral Health for Children's Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about the opening of the hospital's new Craig Yabuki Mental Health Walk-In Clinic. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about what it's been like to be a kid during the pandemic.
The pandemic has had a big impact on all of us, including kids. Take Cora Gruby. She's 11 years old and in the 5th grade. Here she is.
Something fun about me is I like doing my nails and I like hanging out with my friends.
Cora also really wants to do her part to help keep her family, community, and the world safe from COVID-19. She recently sat down with her stepmom, WPR's Andrea Anderson, to talk about what it's like to be a kid in the pandemic.
What is something you want people to know about kids and how their lives have changed during the pandemic?
The main thing is not being able to see friends and family, and also during remote learning, we can't see other people as much. We really just have to stick to our family.
What does that mean for kids? What does that do to them, not being able to see those people?
It makes them pretty sad because if they can't hang out with their friends, they're pretty lonely.
How do you think kids are feeling now, 2 years into the pandemic, versus a year ago?
Well, now I think they're still really upset at the pandemic and why isn't it going away? But for the 1 year, I guess, they were just like, oh, it's okay. It's only a year of our lives. It's fine. But now that's 2 years. We don't know when it's going to stop, but we hopefully think that it's going to stop very, very soon.
And so what do you and your classmates and your friends, what do you feel about the pandemic?
Well, it's not really good, so me and my friends aren't really happy with it. I feel like maybe it's gotten me and my best friend closer because she joined the school, I think, when the pandemic was about to hit or when it already hit. So I really like the part where I met my best friend.
So we're going to turn to a subject that is a little bit polarizing in our environment right now, and that is masks. And I want to ask you, do you wear a mask? And if you do or don't, why?
I do because I'm going to try to stop the spread as much as I as an individual can.
What's it like wearing one during school or at the store?
Well, I got used to it a while ago. But at the beginning, it was really, really different because I'm used to just walking in one without remembering a mask and seeing people's faces differently, like only half of them and stuff like that.
So now we're going to talk about vaccines. And we talk a lot about the COVID-19 vaccines at home because your younger sister, Magnolia, can't be vaccinated yet. And we talked a lot about them before you were eligible to get the vaccine and before your older sister, Lucy, was eligible. And we talked about the science behind them. Did you decide to get vaccinated? And why did you make that decision, Cora?
I did get vaccinated because I really want to try to help out the world without getting anybody sick. And also especially because we have Magnolia at home. And I really do not want her to get sick because she cannot get the vaccine just yet.
Is there anything else that you think people should know about the pandemic?
Well, I think people should know that me and my sister and my friends really like seeing each other. So it's kind of difficult when we can't. So we really want it to stop so we can see each other more often because we don't want to go back onto remote learning, even though some people just like staying in their PJs all day.
That was WPR's Andrea Anderson talking with her daughter, Cora. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, there are a lot of different explanations for why some Wisconsin basements feature a lone standing toilet. Our guest has heard of most of them. He's open to more. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We tackle a wide variety of topics on Central Time with high journalistic standards, and we keep our occasional jokes clean. No toilet humor. This next segment, no exception. We're keeping it classy, but we are talking about toilets, basement toilets, to be specific. Have you seen one of these? You know, Wisconsin basement, a standalone toilet, maybe a partition of some kind. Maybe it's just sitting there in the open, no sink nearby. What's it doing there? Bobby Tanzolo wanted to know. He's senior editor and writer for On Milwaukee. Bobby looked into the question. He wrote about it for the magazine. Bobby, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. It's good to talk to you. It's going to be tough following Cora.
Definitely. Now, I've seen these in a couple places. Somebody in my wife's family had a cottage, and there was this freestanding toilet in the basement there. Moved into our current house. There's a toilet in the corner, no walls around it. Struck me odd. Never saw that in Michigan, only in Wisconsin. You've run into these too, right?
Yeah, I've only seen them in Wisconsin, but they're known to be all over the place. And in fact, one of the nicknames for them is the Pittsburgh potty. And there's a very specific couple of Pittsburgh reasons that that people call them that. So they do exist in other places. I've heard them existing in the southeast of the country, all throughout the Midwest. So they are not unique to Milwaukee, it turns out.
But you started asking around in the Milwaukee area. A lot of people have run into this, right?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in New York City and I never saw one. So when I moved to Milwaukee and we moved into my grandparents' house, they had one in the basement that had sort of a makeshift partition and door, which seemed weird enough to me. But then I came across these other houses where the toilet was just by itself out in the middle of the basement, maybe next to the washing machine, you know, just sitting there. And I thought, what could this possibly be for? Because obviously you think any toilet is for a very specific use.
Right.
But why would anyone want to use that sitting out in the open in the in the basement?
Right under a window, actually, in both the cases I mentioned. Okay, so you started digging into this, Bobby. There are multiple theories about this. What are some of the most common answers you ran into?
Well, the most common one that I have come across in Wisconsin, and also from it's one of the Pittsburgh things, is that it was called a dad's toilet, or was for working men who came home and could go in through a basement entrance and clean up before they came into the living area of the house. And actually, a plumber that I spoke to said that often they do see a shower head next to them above a floor drain, but again, with no partitions, no frills, just like a basically a shower head sticking out of a pipe. So that is obviously a reason. This is definitely a reason they exist in some cases, and is also an effect. We just don't know that it's a cause for why they're there. You know, if it's there, you would use it, right? But that might not be why they're there, because if you don't mind me going on, I'll tell you.
Sure, go for it. Yeah, this is an interesting one.
Yeah, the Pittsburgh potty explanation is that in Western Pennsylvania, and this is apparently the case in other places, where they were not floor drains, apparently, in the basements. So when there were sewer backups, the lowest fixture in the house would be the one that would back up. So you would put a toilet in the basement so that if the sewer backed up, that one would back up into the basement rather than your toilet upstairs backing up into your living quarters. That may or may not be an explanation here because we do have floor drains, but we haven't always had floor drains. So it's possible that some of them existed for that reason before floor drains became common here. Again, with any of these explanations, there's as many questions for each one. Like, why, if it was just a simple thing for a backup situation, why wouldn't you just have a pipe in the corner sticking out of the floor? Why would you pay to have a toilet? You know, why isn't it a sink? Why, you know, I mean, there are questions.
Now, that first answer was mostly geared toward maybe a working class family. Like you said, you get home from the factory, you got some facilities down there. There's another thought that some houses, maybe more middle or upper middle class homes, they were there not for the residents, though, but for people they might have hired to do jobs there.
Yes. So I spoke to a woman who lives on the Upper East Side of Milwaukee in a house that was anything but a working class house. I mean, you often see them in working class houses, but they do also exist in these upper middle class houses and upper class houses where they were believed to be for the help. Often some people suggested it was for gardeners who were working outside. They could come in through the basement entrance, again, not mess up the house. Some people said they were for servants who perhaps lived in the house, or maybe even just cooks who came for the day and then left, you know. It's hard to say for sure. It sounds like a good explanation. In most of the upper class 19th and early 20th century houses that I've been in for stories, they're generally servants' quarters on the third floor, and typically they have facilities of their own up there. But I guess it could be for servants who came and didn't actually live on site.
Now, at the heart of all this for me, Bobby, is the existence of these toilets, again, often without any partition, points toward a different attitude, I guess, toward privacy than I grew up with. Did people think about this stuff different back then? Do you wonder about that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sounds like it, because loads of people who have commented on the story on social media have said they had them in the basement, out in the open. I mean, some were partitioned, but even people who had them out in the open said that they were used. So people were not ashamed, apparently, to use these. I don't know if there was some sort of signal for letting people know. You know, if you heard the door open from upstairs, you're
saying
like,
the whole time. I don't know. Have you run it? So you get three main theories there. Any other explanations that people have offered to you as you're writing the piece or since?
Yeah, no, I had a good one that actually is in the piece from Thomas Hubke, who was a professor emeritus at UWM, who coincidentally recently wrote a book about how working class houses came to be and how they sort of grew into how they became modern, I think is the title, how working class houses became modern. And he talks about the three fixture bathroom being such a huge thing, a huge change, the sink toilet, you know, that setup and the bathtub in working class houses is a big change because initially, of course, there might not be plumbing and the toilet would be out in the backyard. And Tom says that often in his research, he found that the first toilet installed in a house, and this is generally old houses, was installed in the basement because it was definitely a step up from going out in the backyard. So it was seen as an improvement anyway, but also it was much cheaper to put it in the basement.
Less plumbing.
And not spend the money to redecorate and plumb upstairs.
Now, Bobby,
so it's possible that some of the older ones were actually the first, and I've had anecdotally people tell me in comments on social media that the first and only toilet in their house was that basement toilet.
Now you are, I think, still collecting stories. If people have a story to share of their own experience with a basement freestanding toilet.
Oh, absolutely. If people want to tell me more, I'm happy to update the story and keep it going. Of course, everybody says it's there for the obvious reason. But again, I think in a lot of cases that the use of the toilet that's there is an effect rather than the cause.
And how could people reach you with their stories?
Oh, they can email me at Bobby, B-O-B-B-Y, at onmilwaukee.com.
Bobby at onmilwaukee.com.
Yeah.
Bobby, thanks so much for sharing. You always have the most fascinating research from your urban spelunking project. Thank you.
Thank you. I really wanted to flush this one out.
That's Bobby Tadzalo, senior editor and writer for On Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at why some Wisconsin basements feature standalone toilets. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, is it possible to change our personalities on purpose? Our guest tried to do it in 3 months. Find out what she learned about herself and what we can learn from her project. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at new research that says investing in things that improve quality of life could help revitalize towns and cities across the Midwest. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. and the United Nations have raised concerns about possible Russian war crimes in Ukraine. We'll look at war crime laws, how they work, and why they can be difficult to enforce. First, what's your favorite thing about the place where you live? Maybe it's how close you are to a good fishing spot or all the great restaurants in your community. Our next guest says those kinds of things contribute to our quality of life, and investing in them could be a path toward economic revitalization for communities across the Midwest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What makes your community a nice place to live? What are your must-haves? Maybe quality schools, things to do outside in nature? What are the things you wish your community had more of? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Weinstein is an associate professor of economics at the University of Akron in Ohio. She co-authored a recent piece for the Brookings Institution called Improving Quality of Life, Not Just Business, is the Best Path to Midwestern Rejuvenation. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me.
One school of thought when it comes to economic revitalization, say in a Midwestern community of whatever size, has to do with the business environment, lower taxes, lower regulation. You compared that to this quality of life idea. Big picture, what kind of things did you find?
That's right. So we have a little bit of an outdated idea of what can spur economic development, and we think it could be throwing tax abatements at companies. And that's just not what we found. What we found was that higher quality of life, things that make our town nice places to live, not only was associated with higher population growth, it was also associated with higher job growth than the quality of the business environment.
In your research, you didn't just look at the biggest metropolitan areas in the Midwest. Can you talk about the range of communities you looked at?
That's right. So a big gap in the research we found was that a lot of the research on quality of life was focused on large metropolitan areas. And part of that was due to data limitations. So what we did is created this new methodology where we can estimate quality of life in every county across the U.S., and that includes the small counties, which then gives us the ability and gives policymakers of small towns the abilities to see that quality of life matters in small towns and also start to look at, well, what makes places nicer places to live?
What does make places nicer places to live? What are these quality of life enhancers that you found people like to move toward?
Yeah, so we found there are some things that are the same across all places. And one of the things that has the biggest impact on quality of life was the quality of local schools and our local school districts. And if you think about this, every family, every parent out there wants their kids to have a great public education. And that is one of the biggest factors towards increasing quality of life, is just having a great school for our kids. And beyond that, what we did is we kind of looked at three broad categories. So we looked at natural amenities. If you have lakes and creeks nearby, mountains, beaches, those things can help in capitalizing on your natural amenities. Public amenities like having better school quality, low crime rates, better air quality, water quality, and then in even businesses, private amenities. And so with the private amenities and businesses, it's how do those businesses contribute to the quality of life?
Does this mean things are different now than they used to be? Workers have prioritized things differently. People have made different decisions about where we want to live. Or have we always been kind of getting it wrong in that get the jobs and people will come to them idea?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So over the last century, I would say when we had the industrial era of, you know, so where I am in Akron, where we had Goodyear come about and Firestone come about and all of these very large manufacturing places, we really located for the job. And part of that was basically because we had to survive. But as we've seen incomes increase and we now can better afford, you know, our daily necessities in the U.S., now workers don't have to locate just for a job. We can be a little bit pickier. And so what we've seen over the last century is this gradual change, this shift towards living and working in places that we just think are nice to live in.
We're talking to Amanda Weinstein from the University of Akron, co-author of research for the Brookings Institution, that finds that boosting quality of life, that list of a lot of different things, natural resources in the area, cool businesses, that sort of thing, can do more to spur local economic growth in Midwestern communities than things like tax cuts for business owners. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? And what for you is quality of life? What do you need in the community where you live? What makes it an attractive place to live? What could you use? What do you use to determine where you're going to move next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda, one Wisconsin community that comes up in your research is Whitewater, Wisconsin. What kind of things did you find there?
Yeah, so in Whitewater, you look at, they have had population growth. Whitewater is a small town, as you might know, compared to in the Midwest, a lot of small towns have seen declines. So the fact that this small town is seeing population growth is pretty impressive for the Midwest. And one thing that they have is they have great education. So there's a university there and they have, you know, a charming downtown. And one thing that we found and that we kind of talked to policymakers is that it's not about your town becoming whatever town does really well, right? So if you're not Whitewater, you don't want to kind of rubber stamp and become the next Whitewater or rubber stamp and become the next, you know, Silicon Valley or whatever it is. So what you have to do is this kind of inward look and see what makes my town unique and special and build on those assets.
One line that I love in the report is obviously leaders and policymakers can't build a great lake, mountain, or unique natural feature from scratch. I guess that's pretty true. That said, you write in the report that in your state of Ohio, a lot of communities haven't taken advantage of the natural environment where it already does exist. What kind of things can community leaders do?
Oh, that's such a great point. So in Ohio, we have a great lake. And when you look at our Great Lake, especially if you look along the shore from Cleveland to Toledo, we have not capitalized on this Great Lake with bike paths, trails, with multi-use areas for bars and restaurants and apartments and condos. We just haven't built up on this asset that we already have like they have in other areas. If you were to go to San Diego or you go to Miami, right, you can see they are clearly capitalizing on these beach assets. You know, we have beach assets too, maybe a little different. I will give, you know, I will cede that. But we have impressive assets here that we just haven't built up on them the way that other states have with their natural assets.
You also look at the report on the role of women as kind of big decision makers, a key demographic to think about for Midwestern communities. Why is that?
Yeah, so this is an interesting result we found with another paper where women actually show stronger preferences for the Midwest than men do. And some of this, I think, has to do with culture and a culture of being friendly and welcoming. I think about my neighbors who will watch my kid and I can text them, hey, I can't pick up my kid from the bus stop. Can you pick them up? Right. This culture is really helpful for especially women raising a family. But what that also means is that Midwestern policymakers need to have a good sense of what women want and need in their city.
How can business owners tap into these sort of ideas? What can they do to help boost quality of life in their community?
I think business owners can do so much. I think business owners and entrepreneurs and maybe future business owners can think about, what do I want from my community? If I want a cute little furniture store, if I want to rehab, you know, old furniture I find, or open a restaurant or open a bar. So it's thinking about, what do I want in my community, and kind of having the gumption to do it yourself. But even if you have, you know, an accounting firm, let's say, or a consulting business, it's also making sure you're offering quality of life to your employees by making sure they have work-life balance to actually enjoy the amenities that they have around them.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess Green Bay and the northeast Wisconsin along the Fox River is an excellent example. Between the state government, local governments, and the industries, they've spent well over $1 billion cleaning up the Fox River and restoring the environment around it. And it's brought in a whole lot of business that's growing. I don't have the numbers, but I know that's better than it used to be. People come from all over the country to fish the walleye fishery here. It's a world-class fishery now. And I live here because within 10 minutes, I can be fishing or hunting. And within 20 minutes, I can get any medical care I need. And since I'm retired, that's pretty important to me.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing that observation and your personal story. Tom says, hey, I can go fish and I can go get good medical care nearby. That's a recipe for some communities, I imagine, Amanda.
Yeah, that's such a great point that Tom brought up, because we often hear communities say things like, well, I don't have the warm weather and beaches in Miami, so I'm just going to throw up my hands. There's nothing I can do. But the truth is, not everyone wants that. We are all kind of more different, and we like different things, right? Look in, you know, a cereal aisle, how many different cereals there are. Think about the same thing with cities, right? Some people might really want the beach and that sunny weather, but some people want to go fishing and they want to go hunting. And there are so many different things our cities can offer people other than a beach and sunny weather.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We're talking to Amanda Weinstein from the University of Akron about her new research for the Brookings Institution, looking at quality of life improvements, how they could help revitalize Midwestern communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What things in your community improve your quality of life? A farmer's market, the schools, parks, natural environment, hunting and fishing, the music scene? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the economic impact of things like quality schools, public transportation, natural amenities, and new research that says investing in those things can help revitalize communities in the Midwest. Amanda Weinstein with the University of Akron stays with us. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Just a few minutes left. If you have something you point to as something that really boosts the quality of life in your community, maybe something that drew you there in the first place, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Amanda, suppose there's a community leader in a smaller community, maybe an old factory town where the factory is closed, or maybe doesn't employ as many people as it used to. Where do they start in terms of trying to figure out what they could do to boost their quality of life to meet the unique character of their community?
I think it starts with making sure you get the basics right. So the basics meaning you have, you know, great schools are just one of the basic things. Access to childcare is a basic thing that families need. And get the basics done and do it well, effectively, efficiently. And then start to really have a conversation. And maybe this is conversations with the community, with who is this community? And there are communities across the Midwest having this conversation right now when a factory closes, saying, who are we really? Were we really just the town that made this appliance? And what they're finding is they're not. They are finding they're the town who invented, you know, Ferris wheels, for example. So they're building a new Ferris wheel park. And they're having conversations to find out who they really are, which is bringing back kind of a unique character to cities that many cities, you know, maybe think they've lost.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jeff is with us in Madison. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I'd like to extol the virtues of good transportation networks, especially in Madison, where we have an excellent bicycle system of bike paths, bikeways, and isolated, separated bike paths. It makes it really easy to get around from many neighborhoods, and at times like this, when gasoline prices are real high, biking around is a great way to save money.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So that kind of transportation infrastructure, Amanda, in this case, the bike scene.
Oh, that's such a great point that Jeff brought up. So I think when we have multi-mode transportation, whether it's walking, biking, other ways to get around, public transportation, it gives consumers options. And we like options. We should know this about Americans, right? Again, look at the cereal aisle. We like options. And I love that he brought up when we do this, it not only makes our place nice to live, but it also helps us, you know, avoid paying high gas prices if we don't want to pay for those high gas prices, which gives consumers more bargaining power on many markets when they have more options. So it's not only great for consumer power in markets, it's actually great for making a city nice to live. And I often hear policymakers in places that are cold, in Ohio, places like Wisconsin, a little bit defeatist, saying, well, it's cold, right? People won't go out when it's cold. But if you look at places like Amsterdam, you see people walking and biking in the snow, right? I just don't think that's true. I think we don't have the options that other countries have when it comes to how to get around in their city.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Katie joins us now in Janesville. Katie, hello.
Hey there.
What did you want to bring up, Katie?
So we moved to the area from Utah, and we had the option to move to San Diego or Phoenix or anywhere of these like nice hot places, but we actually chose Wisconsin on purpose. Because, yes, it is a colder climate, but the schools are really good. It's not very expensive to live here. There's a lot of outdoor activities specifically for my family. Something I wish that Janesville had was indoor playgrounds, kind of like Madison does. But other than that, it's been absolutely wonderful to live here.
Katie, thank you so much for sharing that. So Janesville beat out San Diego and others. Amanda, thanks in part to those natural resources and cost of living.
Yeah, that's such a good point that Katie brought up. I mean, I think what she brought up is really important, right? So she clearly has kids, and what she wishes that she had are indoor playgrounds, right? This is something any city can have. Any city can build a playground. And so one city I like to point out in the Midwest that's done particularly well in Ohio is Columbus, Ohio. And sorry to Columbus, Ohio. Columbus, Ohio has nothing special about it. It just doesn't. Everything they have built. They have built a great zoo. They have built great amenities, great museums, indoor playgrounds. Everything that makes Columbus nice was built. And so I think having a place like an indoor playground is something very simple, but can be really impactful for when you do have, you know, those cold times where you're not going to go out on a playground, right? Then it gives you more options to enjoy your city year round.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me. This was such a great discussion. I love hearing these stories.
That's Amanda Weinstein. She's an associate professor of economics at the University of Akron in Ohio. With us today to talk about her research for the Brookings Institution titled Improving Quality of Life, Not Just Business, is the Best Path to Midwestern Rejuvenation. This week, WPR is marking 2 years of the pandemic here in Wisconsin with stories about how COVID-19 has changed us in lasting ways. Betsy Block got COVID-19 in late 2020 on the tail end of Wisconsin's first big wave of infections. Like thousands of others, she fought through the disease in the hospital, even giving birth to a daughter while she was in a medical coma. Rob Mentzer reports on how the experience changed Block's life.
Betsy Block doesn't remember the end of 2020 or the beginning of 2021. She remembers getting in the ambulance on Christmas night. She would spend weeks in a medically induced coma with COVID-19.
I only remember the beginning of February. I don't remember anything in January.
When she was admitted to the hospital, Betsy was 7 months pregnant. Just days later, as she was being medically sedated, the baby's vital signs began to crash. Doctors performed an emergency cesarean section. Without even knowing it, Betsy had her third daughter, Jennifer.
I was told in February, yeah, that I had the baby. They didn't tell me what day or anything.
Jennifer's birthday was December 29th. While the baby went into the intensive care unit, doctors rushed Betsy to a different hospital. Her mom, Kim Engel, says Betsy needed access to an ECMO machine, essentially a life support system that could breathe for her.
They said, we can't wait till the last minute. She has to be there if she's going to be put on it.
Later in January, baby Jennifer would be released to Betsy's husband, Justin, and their family in rural central Wisconsin. But Betsy would spend weeks in the hospital hooked up to the ECMO machine, and it would be months before she could come home. Betsy's case was complex. In addition to COVID, she was diagnosed with blastomycosis, a rare fungal disease that also attacks the lungs. Even after she was out of the coma, she faced an agonizing period in the hospital, struggling for air.
I had looked it up on my phone, too, and the survival rate's not high. So I was like, okay, I'm not going to leave this hospital, at least not alive. That's what my thought was, you know.
But slowly, she got better. Her lungs still aren't normal, but she can breathe and get around. Betsy came home from the hospital last March. That's when she held Jennifer for the first time. Bonding with Jennifer was hard. Just readjusting to being at home was hard.
I would have panic attacks if the kids would get too loud. It sounds horrible, but when you're in a hospital room with beeps and boops and stuff like that, you get used to that.
In October, Engel organized a community fundraiser for Betsy and her family. Church members, family friends, and supporters gathered in the town of Merrill. Betsy's daughters drew with chalk in the parking lot. 5-year-old Amelia showed off her drawing of her family.
This is my dad, that's my mom, and this is the grass.
Donations from the event and raffle tickets they sold helped Betsy's family recover income they lost while Betsy was hospitalized. For a lot of that time, her husband Justin couldn't work either. And in October, they were also worried about hospital bills that they had yet to see. They found out in December that the state attributed her hospital stay to COVID, not blastomycosis, and the costs were covered. Betsy says her sickness changed her. It's not just the tracheotomy scar or the fact that she needs an inhaler now due to permanent lung damage. She's quieter, more inwardly directed. Justin says that's to be expected.
After that kind of a time period away and they come home and, you know, she doesn't come home the same person she was when she left. You know, you go through a life issue like that and you're not the same person anymore.
Wisconsin has confirmed some 1.4 million cases of COVID-19 in the 2 years since the pandemic began. More than 12,000 people have died. Even among those who've recovered, like Betsy, the disease has left lasting scars.
I do have a long way to go, but I'm here.
Today, she says she's working on moving forward and creating a new life. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Follow more reporting over at WPR.org/news, including the 2-year anniversary COVID reports. Coming up after the news, we explore war crime laws and whether Vladimir Putin and others could be prosecuted for their actions in Ukraine. Two Marquette University experts who have written about war crime laws will join us in just a few minutes. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.